raises further questions about NYPD tactics.
Welcome to Kiteline, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here in Kiteline, we hope to share these messages with you across the prison walls.
Recently, Alabama inmate Ronald Burt Smith Jr. was executed for a 1994 murder. Smith had previously brought a lawsuit against the state of Alabama, which was dismissed in November, claiming that the state's three-drug execution process constituted cruel and unusual punishment. His execution took 34 minutes, and for 13 of them, he was coughing and moving, according to sources. His lawyers attest that his arm moved and his lips appeared to be forming words. Lethal injection involves three different drugs, the first of which is a sedative, which once it's judged to have taken place, more drugs are administered that paralyze the body and stop the heart. While Smith's executioners waited for the sedative to work, he underwent two consciousness tests, which consists of, quote, the corrections officer calling out Smith's name, brushing his eyebrows back, and pinching him under his left arm, unquote. Death by lethal injection is widely contested as a means of carrying out the death penalty, as the efficiency of the sedatives is in doubt. NPR reports that Smith and other Alabama death row plaintiffs referenced the death of Clayton Lockett and the failure of the sedative in the lawsuit. When Smith was convicted, the jury recommended life without parole, but the judge chose the death penalty. Alabama is the only state that allows a judge to override the jury's recommendation and assign the death penalty. Smith's case was used to contest Alabama's law in the Supreme Court, but it was denied. The Chicago Tribune reports that Alabama Corrections Commissioner Jeff Dunn promises that an autopsy will be performed on Smith to see if there are any irregularities in his death aside from it being administered by the state, saying, quote, I think the question is probably better left to the medical experts, unquote.
According to the Washington Post, a new report by the Council for Court Excellence concludes that the situation is bleak for ex-prisoners looking for shelter and work in Washington, D.C., because the city is expensive and many of its jobs require a college education. The report notes that 1 in 22 adults in Washington, D.C. lives under some sort of correctional control, such as jail or probation. Most of the returning prisoners are African American. The report found that over 1 in 5 employed ex-prisoners in D.C. do not have secure housing when they leave prison, and those unemployed are more likely to live in homeless shelters or on the street. The report also made some recommendations. Among them are permitting prisoners to apply for housing up to 90 days before they leave prison, as well as having the D.C. Council pass laws prohibiting landlords from discriminating against people with criminal records.
At least one prisoner died during a riot that broke out at the Saskatchewan Penitentiary in Canada on Wednesday. Jason Leonard Bird was 43. Prisoners refused to lock up and return to their cells. The conflict then escalated rapidly past negotiation to direct confrontation. Prisoners smashed the cameras, lights, and windows before setting up barricades. Special riot response squads broke down the defenses and stormed the units held by prisoners. At least 5 prisoners were injured at this point, and guards discovered Bird's body as well. The cause of his death is allegedly under investigation. On Friday, December 2nd, Free Alabama Movement member Robert Earl Council, a.k.a. Kinetic Justice, was brutally attacked while handcuffed by 2 officers, Dozier and Shoulders, at the Limestone Correctional Facility. The attack occurred while he was being escorted to the shower. He was pushed to the floor by 1 officer and was attacked while handcuffed. Afterwards, the 2nd officer pulled the 1st officer off and sprayed Kinetic Justice with mace and then forced him into his cell. There is a standing request to call the Limestone Correctional Facility at 256-233-4600 in response to this assault. Here's a suggested script. I'm calling to demand that you release Robert Council from solitary confinement and move him out of Limestone Correctional Facility immediately. He was brutally beaten on December 2nd and continues to fear for his life. This week, we're sharing a conversation we had with Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue and also American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination. Christian spoke at IU earlier this month on the history of policing in America, but we were eager to pick his brain about the intersection of police, racism, and prisons. He argues that exceptional instances of torture, Abu Ghraib for example, rest firmly on a daily and banal foundation of normalized torment, mistreatment, and violence. This relationship is familiar to us from the long letters we've received from the secure housing unit at Wabash Correctional Facility and from the deaths in custody quietly covered up in the Westville Maximum Security Unit here in Indiana. Here's Christian.
I ended up writing a book about torture kind of by mistake. I had just finished work on Our Enemies in Blue, which is this large history of the police in the United States, and the Abu Ghraib scandal broke in the news. The way that that controversy got discussed, I don't know, it just infuriated me, largely because people on all sides had this, used the same line to describe it, which is, this isn't how we do things in America. So critics of the administration said that as, you know, this is outrageous, this isn't keeping with our values, that sort of meaning. Defenders of the administration said it as just a denial that this was even occurring, right? But the line was the same, and it, having just written this book about the police and having done a lot of secondary research about prison as part of that, I knew that it was very much was how we did things in America. And I don't know, something like the thousandth time I heard that, I just got mad enough that I ended up writing an entire book on torture. Part of what I argue in American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination, is that there isn't a sharp break between everyday practices of violent institutions and the atrocity stories like Abu Ghraib. And that part of what made Abu Ghraib hard for the public to understand was that it was treated as this kind of exceptional case. And so people started looking for things that made those circumstances unique. Really, I think to understand the torture that occurred there, it was much more important to look at the routine operations of the military, the prison system, interestingly, the domestic prison system, because many of the guards that were implicated as leaders in Abu Ghraib were, in fact, prison guards in the U.S., and the intersection of those institutions, and the way that the normal violence, the normal methods of control, were really just present in kind of a concentrated form, and somebody was dumb enough to take pictures. It was really the pictures that set that aside from similar incidents that had already been reported in the New York Times, that had already been reported in the Washington Post, but always fell somewhere around like page 18 and never really created the sense of scandal, the sense of crisis, the sense of controversy. Toward the end of Our Enemies in Blue, I have a chapter called Your Friendly Neighborhood Police State. And in that, I look at the two main institutional developments in policing since the 1970s, those being militarization and community policing. And typically the way these get discussed is that there's like a nice option and a mean option, and tough on crime want to take the mean option, and nice liberal progressive bleeding hearts want to take the nice option. What I found in doing the research is that actually both of these developed at the same time and in response to the same social conditions, that especially the political crisis of the 1960s and the civil rights movement. And in fact, they were often implemented simultaneously in the same cities, and that there was often a crossover between, for example, commanders who would be in charge of riot control or the SWAT team, and the same commanders would be in charge of a department's community policing. Interestingly, Daryl Gates, who's famously on the hard-nosed end of this, and invented things like, you know, the SWAT team, most notably, also invented things like the DARE program and the basic car plan, where a couple of officers were responsible for sort of community relations in a particular area. And he tried very hard to make the case that the LAPD had been doing community policing, you know, all along, which most people responded to by laughing, but I found myself in the awkward position of agreeing with him. Militarization and community policing weren't these two competing developments. They were two complementary aspects of a single development, which, if we combine them and look at them as a whole, turns out to look a lot like counterinsurgency. When I first made this argument in 2004, I was pretty trepidatious about it. I kind of half suspected that I had just gone off the rails. And then the U.S. invaded Iraq. Suddenly there was a lot of interest in military science and intellectual circles and the RAND Corporation, people like that, about doing counterinsurgency again. And the places that they looked for models of how to do it were American police departments. And they started explicitly making the same argument that I had made in Our Enemies in Blue. To understand this, though, part of what we need to realize is that militarization isn't just assault rifles or armored personnel carriers or the sort of equipment and materiel and armament. It's also a way of organizing a police department to resemble a military. And the real change, the more important than the assault rifles and the military surplus gear, was the changes in the structure of police departments and police discipline. I mean, Daryl Gates explicitly uses the term platoon in terms of how he reorganized the Los Angeles Police Department. Those factors are part of the day-to-day operations of the police and part of how they operate in the community, regardless of whether they're wearing Kevlar vests or whether they're wearing polo shirts. The most obviously militaristic aspects of it are incidental to the overall process of militarization. And I think the strategic orientation toward counterinsurgency is part and parcel of that whole change. So before the 1960s, the police were largely seen as a political instrument that more powerful actors used. And it was especially true in the period of machine politics, where really police jobs were given as rewards for political reliability, and the police as a body were expected to support the reigning administration by, among other things, mustering votes for Election Day and suppressing the votes of the opposition. The reforms of the 20th century were largely focused on that relationship between the police and the political machines. And really, they were focused on destroying the political machines, and getting control of the police was seen as part of that. And they tended in the direction of increasing the independence of the police. So the police, so that even if police chiefs served at the pleasure of the mayor, the individual officers didn't. And this did have the effect of reducing corruption, at least institutionalized corruption of the kind that we saw before. But it also, it increased the autonomy of the institution and made it more and more insulated from not just the bad kind of political influence that we were just talking about, but also any sort of accountability to directly the community, but even to the government in the cities that they operate in. And one of the unintended consequences of that period of reform was this sort of increased insularity of the police as an institution, a development of a subculture within policing, and then this sort of realization that they could be not only a class in themselves, but a class for themselves. Coming out of that, there was a period of police unionization and this kind of militant right-wing politics within policing that had really always been part of the institution, but was becoming increasingly explicit, increasingly sort of self-directed. And the move toward unionization institutionalized that sort of political force. Importantly, as the police were unionizing, really starting in the late 40s, but gaining steam in the late 60s, the city officials allowed unionization as long as the police did not affiliate with other unions. There are a few exceptions to that, but that was the general pattern. As long as the police weren't in the AFL-CIO, as long as the police weren't in the same union as other municipal workers, they were allowed to organize. And as a result, the police unions developed a character of organizing the police as police rather than organizing the police as workers. And the union itself became this method of maintaining the identity within the institution and a kind of vertical solidarity between the cops and their bosses, which is fundamentally different than how other labor unions work, at least in principle. Because they came to represent the police as police, they often became the spokesman for the interests of the institution and not just the interests of the membership, which means that it put the cops in this position of advocating for the policies that were going to determine how policing was done. One result of that is that there was this unaccountable body monopolizing force within city governments that other parts of the government needed to appeal to. And when the behavior of the cops became impossible for mayors or city councils or even police chiefs to defend, there was this other set of representation that only had to answer to the cops themselves. So the job of the police union became defending the indefensible. At the same time, it became very convenient for city governments, mayors, city councils, whatever, to grant the police a lot of that power, a lot of that independence, as a way of then not having to be responsible for what the cops did. The mayor could very easily agree to contract terms that would make the police impossible to discipline, and then when the police did something atrocious, cry some crocodile tears and say, well, you know, there's really nothing I can do here because we're locked into this contract. Of course, we see something very similar in prison guard unions, especially in California, where the prison guard union is one of not just the largest labor organizations, but also one of the largest lobbying groups, one of the biggest contributors to political campaigns. You know, for decades, the conventional wisdom has been that you may be able to win with an election without their support, but you're probably not going to be able to win an election over their opposition. Functionally, it occupies the same kind of place in state politics as police unions do usually in city politics. So it's interesting to look at the advantages that community policing brings to the police. When this gets sold as a program, it usually gets sold as an idea that is going to improve police-community relations, and the thing that gets foregrounded there is benefits to the community. But it's always the police who are pushing it, so it begs the question, like, well, what's in it for them? And they're pretty explicit in the professional literature that what they gain from it is by more regular, more routine, more casual contact, a familiarity with the community, with the institutions in the community, with the leadership in the community, and that also that allows them to build relationships and gain a sense of trust. Ultimately, what that gives them is more information that they would not have otherwise in terms of who has influence and where there's tension and, you know, sort of how the community operates, but also specific things in terms of people are more likely to call them and report crimes. One of the dynamics that takes hold then is that the police tend to sort of conceptually divide the community into people who are supportive of them and people who are opposed to them. And this, again, directly follows from counterinsurgency theory, that there are parts of the population whose support you can count on, there are parts of the population whose opposition you can count on, and then there is a middle that you are sort of, that the authorities are competing for with the insurgents. And the way that translates into policing is that there are, you know, the people who are going to join the neighborhood watch, there are the people who are going to be supportive of the police kind of no matter what. There are people who are going to be in opposition to the police, and then there's the middle, and they're trying to gain ground in that middle. Community policing helps them do that. And the hope is that by doing that, that they're going to not just win compliance, not just suppress criticism, but also that they will gain information about their adversaries, whether you look at that in political terms of people who are politically opposed to them, or whether you look at that in sort of legal terms of people who are breaking the law. Another element there, then, is that the parts of the population that the police tend to look at for, say, leadership, you know, they tend to be what we might refer to as the respectable classes. They tend to be property owners, they tend to be business owners, they tend to be professional class people. And the people that they look to in terms of the as the sort of adversary tend to be what in the 19th century would have been referred to as the criminal classes, right? They tend to be poorer, they tend to be homeless, they tend to be people of color, etc. And there's a tendency within community policing to define the community in a way that excludes some populations and amplifies the position of other populations, and that tends to track class and race hierarchies. The result then ultimately being that the police have more information, more access, and more legitimacy, even in the communities that they are repressing, but more or less the same groups of people tend to bear the brunt of police work as did previously. So that gives the cops more resources and more familiarity. You know, they will know who is on parole, they will know who is on probation, they will often know the precise terms, and they'll have more information about the family connections, who is or used to be in a gang with whom, who goes to church with whom, that sort of thing. So that even if they're not pursuing direct criminal charges, if they just need to put pressure on people, they have a lot of different avenues to leverage that. Whether that's just making their life uncomfortable to try to dissuade them from, on the one hand, crime, or on the other hand, political activism, or whether that's applying that kind of pressure to then turn them into an informant so that they can then get more information and pursue whatever investigation they're pursuing. I guess none of that is incidental to community policing. That is the purpose. That is why the police are interested in it. That, and it gives them legitimacy, which then reduces the opposition they face. The way this works, typically, is that the police in a community policing program will start by doing things that are not just unobjectionable, but really hard to argue with, right? So they'll have community meetings, they'll listen to what the problems are, people will complain about things that maybe not even really like law enforcement issues, like it's dangerous crossing the street, and then the police will go to some other part of the city government and like make sure that there's a crosswalk put in. It establishes this relationship with the community where they will view the police as problem solvers and they will view the police as people who will listen to them. Really, it's like sort of Alinsky-style community organizing with guns. The result of that is that as that relationship progresses, the police tell us, like, hey, who are the people who are causing these problems? Who are the people who are, you know, like, who are the bad actors? Often this is just ham-fisted and does not go anywhere, right? Because people see through it, because the distrust is so deep, because the relationship that they have with their neighbors or with their cousin or whatever is a lot stronger than the relationship they have with some guy who showed up at a meeting once and got them a crosswalk. Other times, however, the police are able to like really develop relationships. And even within communities of color, even within poor communities, are able to identify influential people who will cooperate with them, who will loan them some of the legitimacy that they already have, which they can then use to help sort of, I guess as they see it, identify the bad actors. Often the way that plays out is gain this kind of community mandate to push out homeless people, to push out poor people, to concentrate policing in, you know, certain hotspots, which may just be where people of color, especially young men, hang out, whether that's a park or a corner or whatever, may also be like a housing development, something like that, right? So race and class elements in terms of who gets targeted as the problem and how the police approach those problems are built into how this policing is done. And importantly, because it's built into how it's done, it doesn't actually have to be intended by anyone. It doesn't have to be intended by the people in the neighborhood who just want to, like, you know, be able to walk down the street safely. It doesn't have to be intended by the cop who is, you know, trying to help those people make the neighborhood safe, but it is built into how this shakes out. You know, some of the ways that this plays out at policy level are police arguing on behalf of people in neighborhoods for governments not to locate low-income housing there, right? You'll see business associations pushing for more community police programs like foot patrols, bike patrols, that sort of thing, because cops in the cars don't really do anything about panhandling, but cops on foot will, right? It's largely just a function of the police role in society that, in general, they go about their jobs in ways that will try to get them benefits and avoid hassle. And the practical, the real politic result of that is that that means that they tend to do things that serve the interests of powerful people, and they tend to do things that are harmful to powerless people. because if you try doing that the other way, then you get fewer benefits and more hassle. I mean, it's just a function of the inequality in society overall, but the police have a special institutional role in maintaining that inequality and in doing so with violence. I think that it is too early to know what the ultimate effect of Black Lives Matter and sort of related developments are going to be. In the short term, we've seen that really for the first time, it's attached real political costs to the militarization of the police, and it's attached real political costs to the impunity that the police enjoy. So all of a sudden, people like Eric Holder, Barack Obama, police chiefs were concerned about militarization, right? I mean, these are exactly the same people who coordinated it. So the thing that changed was that now there's a cost attached to it. Similarly, the number of police who were prosecuted for killing people on duty in the year following Ferguson tripled. Now, before you get too excited, tripling means it went from 5 to 15 out of about 1,100 people that the police kill every year. But nevertheless, from 5 to 15 is a remarkable and sudden increase. And I think that can only be because prosecutors other places looked at what happened when they didn't prosecute the officer in Ferguson or shortly thereafter in New York and decided that they would rather have the hassle of prosecuting a cop than have the hassle of not taking it to trial and seeing the city catch fire.
Kiteline. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, Kiteline Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. Kiteline wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message to be played on the air at 812-269-2512. Or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one behind bars. You can hear previous episodes of our show or get more information on the prisoners or stories covered on Kiteline at our website, kitelineradio.noblogs.org. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Kiteline is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been Kiteline. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for more stories, news, and insights about the impact of prison on our communities. Thank you for listening.